I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Are you ready?
Hey guys, come on, bring it in. Welcome back to the podcast dedicated to the most precious human pastime. I sit down with friends, idols, and inspirations of mine to shoot the breeze about music, life, family, food, whatever. I'm Gregory Porter, and this is The Hang.
I think the thing that maybe I'm aiming for is a sense of my own peacefulness with the realization that I'm going to make a whole bunch of music and some of it's going to work and some of it's not going to work. But if there's a sense of trust that I can build between me and my audience, then that will last longer than any particular flavor of the moment.
You cannot begrudge talent, but Jacob Collier, I'm sorry, it's not fair. One person should not be allowed to have so much.
I didn't believe it was true for a second until I saw his face on the Skype. And it's like, no, that's Quincy Jones. He was like, hey, man, how many girlfriends have you got? And I was like, think fast. 27. He was like, oh, man, I only got 22. You know, and it was like, oh, geez.
I'm such a huge fan and you are going to enjoy this for sure.
I was still on a journey. I feel like I'm just getting started, man.
So here, sit back, grab a drink, and let's do this. Come on. Jacob Collier, man, thank you for hanging out with me. This is The Hang, and where do we speak to you from?
Gregory, it's so good to see you, man. We are speaking, I suppose, from about 8,000 kilometers apart. I'm in North London, and you must be in California or something.
Yeah, I'm in Bakersfield, California, man.
Beautiful, man.
Wonderful. And we find ourselves in this difficult time for all of us, but an interesting time, possibly a very creative time. But there's a lot of disappointment because we haven't been able to do what it is that we do. But I think as I hear in your music and what I know of your personality, both private and publicly, you're an optimistic person. And I know, and you're a workaholic. Judging from all of the instruments and technology, I know that you use this time to create. Have you been making music? I see you actually every day doing something new on social media. Social media, so you are staying busy as hell.
You're right. You're so right, man. I can't stop. You know, it's weird. I miss touring so much. I'm sure you feel the same.
Yeah,
it's an unprecedented time. I think a lot of people are trying to solve problems in brand new ways. You know, things that we've never attempted before. But honestly, I'm grateful. I'm really, really grateful for this time. And you know, I've been bestowed a little swathe of time to be at home with family in this room that I learned music in for longer than I ever dreamed it would ever be possible again. You know, I sort of thought, well, I'm never going to be home for more than 2 weeks at one time because I'll have to be jetting off to somewhere for some reason or some performance or some, you know, whatever it happens to be. And it's been really, really cool to be able to be at home and invest some time in my space and in myself a little bit. But
yeah,
honestly, I haven't stopped since March.
Yeah, man, I It's a strange thing because it's two things that happen. You miss it, but then it is a great thing to be able to have this time. I'm you know, I see you everywhere around the world. Most times you're just leaving as I get there.
We keep passing like ships in the night. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, you probably keep a schedule like me close to 200 appearances or shows or whatever a year.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah.
And so those times where you have 2 weeks of uninterrupted status in one place, in your home, is unusual. So that we've had. And I think sometimes, I don't know what your process is musically. We'll talk about that. I don't know if you need space and time. I don't know if you do well with movement. I don't know if travel is inspiring to you, or, you know, are you surrounding yourself with listening to different things, or are you just giving yourself time to pull things out of your own head? And that is a vast head that you have. I'm not saying you have a big head. I'm saying
vast headed. Yeah, no, I feel you. It feels vast to me at times, for sure. It's this unending kind of whirlpool of ideas and things. And I love the way you put it, actually, about sort of extracting things, time to extract things from your own universe, from your own world, things you love, things you're challenged by. I think it's amazing to have that time. And golly, it's really rare when you're touring to have, as you say, two weeks of uninterrupted time.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, I'm a huge introvert at heart, right? And I learned music very much sort of as a self-led learner. I'm quite an autodidact in a sense. And a lot of my process has been about play, and play in solitude in part, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of learning music is about playing with others. But for me, a lot of my production experiments and songwriting process has come from being in this very room, actually, and just mucking around. And mucking around takes time.
Yeah.
You know, mucking around doesn't happen overnight. And I don't think that, you know, it's possible to grow a skill set in a flash. And right. I feel like sometimes people look at, you know, somebody like yourself or someone like me and think, well, we just sort of dropped into the world fully formed, you know.
Right.
But I think the reality is that to work a craft and to get used to using it and operating within it and knowing where to put yourself within your process, how much of yourself you give, that takes time and it takes space. And so I feel, you know, like I'm able to sort of, you know, luxuriate in a little bit more time to breathe, space to think. And whilst traveling is highly inspirational for me, and I love being in a rush, you know, I feel like that brings something out of me that I can't get otherwise. I'm really thrilled to figure out what on earth to do with my life now that I'm not in so much of a rush, and I'm really benefiting from that.
Yeah. Well, I think your the palette of music that you're interested in and that interests you, and even that you have a command of, is impressive. And I'm just curious about the foundation of that. I suspect, because I like to be somewhat of a psychic or a mystic about these things, and just imagine what your youth was like and how you come to develop and craft this domicile that is you, this music house that you have. Who helped put it together? What did you listen to build this thing that you have? Tell me about your influences and your parents. Who helped you?
Oh, great questions, man, really. So I was brought up basically by a single mother. I'm the eldest of three children, and we grew up listening to literally everything in the world, right? So we had Stevie on really heavy rotation. People like Sting were really important. Bobby McFerrin for the voice for me was a complete game changer. And in tandem, you know, you had things like Bartok and Stravinsky and Benjamin Britten and Bach and these rich classical composers who gave me such a sense of grounding, I think. And then you had the jazzers. You know, I grew up on Miles, and it was really important, and Cannonball and Coltrane, and that whole side of things was kind of revolutionary for me. And then you had the Joneys and the Bob Dylans. And I guess I was also really interested in some of the stuff that my mum tried to get me into early, and I didn't get it. And I got it when I was about 14. But, you know, things like Beck and Bjork and a lot of kind of left field stuff that's really out there and kind of interesting sonically, you know, not just harmonically, melodically, rhythmically, but actually in terms of sound and placement of sound. And I was super lucky to have this room as a space. You know, when I was seven, I got my hands on Cubase, which is like a music software for layering tracks. And when I was 11, I upgraded from that to Logic, back when Logic was still owned by eMagic, you know. And that whole era of my life was a fascinating one because it was my first canvas, you know, and I was able to conceive of a sound and then make the sound exist, whether it was through my voice or from something I found on the computer or a Casio MIDI keyboard or whatever it was. It was a place I could make things happen, a place I could birth things and edit things and zoom into a process. And I really loved that. And once I had a little taste of it, you know, at the beginning, I really couldn't get enough. And I would set myself these challenges, you know, see if you could arrange this song in a crazy way. You know, how far can you push the harmonic vocabulary? How much can you push the rhythm? And you know, I wasn't really particularly much of an instrumentalist at any point in my life, really. Well, especially at that time, I was a musician. I was listening to music. I was learning how to understand it and arrange it and write it more than I was spending time at the piano or at the bass or at the drums, you know, all these different things. And it's funny because later on, you know, when I was, I suppose, about 15, 16, I started to play more piano and learn what it was to actually be a pianist. But that was really new for me because at first it was really like I was listening to the music that was being played by the piano, but I couldn't do anything on the piano itself. I couldn't even put my thumb underneath my fingers as I was playing scales. It was like I would hop up and down with my four fingers and, you know, but I was such a self-led learner, and I learned from listening. I didn't learn from practicing and from teachers and stuff like this. Really, I was my own boss. Mm-hmm. And the thing I'm most grateful for when I look back at my childhood was a space to create and the trust that my voice was valid, you know? And there was always, with my mum, there was always a set of listening ears. And if I had something I wanted to explore or say or examine or question or break, you know, it was safe. It was safe to break it, safe to expand on that.
Who gives you that license? I mean, we hold these truths, you know, to be self-evident that you are given these unalienable rights, but quite frankly, you're not. You there are some fears, sometimes some natural barriers that you have to get through, that sometimes that it requires, most oftentimes, mama to say, yes, you can do that. You can do that, son.
Right, right, right.
And so did you have that? She, I mean, just hearing what you were listening to from Bartok to Bjork. That's dope. That's so dope. You know,
I loved it all, man. And you're so right about the mama, you know, the force of the mama and yeah, Susie, you know, Susie Collier completely birthed that space in my life. I mean, she birthed my life, obviously, but the space for me to be safe to play and all that stuff. I think that really came from her. And I'm definitely a believer in the idea that children aren't born with fear. I don't think a child comes into the world with fear and limitation and judgment and these things. I don't think that's how it works. I think that children come into the world as these infinite seers and beings, and they can do it. They can feel it all. They can do it all. They can see it all. And I think that, you know, the more that is encouraged, the more it lives and breathes and talks. Yeah. And I think it's actually really rare to make it out of childhood with that voice still in your head.
Well, okay.
Because, you know, what happens is the fear comes from outside and it comes in and closes those voices down. You know?
Right. It has to be protected. So this freedom that was afforded you, it has to be protected. It can be closed off by one teacher, one critic, or even a group of friends to say, oh, that's stupid. Oh, that's dumb.
Yeah.
Oh, that's,
what you thinking, man?
Oh, that's nerdy.
Ridiculous.
Oh, that's, they can put a whole bunch
that's
of mean,
yeah.
mean names to it.
You're so right, man. I it's funny because music is not, you know, music is not math. It's much more like science in my mind, in the sense that it's flexible. You know, it's not like 2 + 2 always equals 4. It can equal something different depending on who you are.
Yeah.
And I think the fascinating thing about these chemical reactions that we chase as songwriters, creators, live performers, those moments of absolute magic, synergy, connection, those things can't be designed by any particular method. But I think that if there's one thing that I sort of adhere to, it's the child in me that knew it all along, you know, because I think children are the wisest among us. And I think it's a dangerous time when you go through school, because as you say, one person who you know says something that closes you down or you know shuts you off or makes a judgment, that can be the ruination of someone's openness. And you know, I think that all of us, you know, me included, have to spend a lot of time and energy kind of unraveling the people in our lives that have done that to us, and to try and reconnect with the parts of ourselves that are beyond those challenges. And I think the thing that I'm realizing is that they're all there. You know, you can always find the child in you, and you can always find the part of you that had the answers and that knew and saw it before there was this idea of, oh, this is right and this is wrong, or this is the way it should be done. And if you don't do it the way that I do it, then, you know, you're a loser, or you're never going to fit in. And, you know, I feel like almost everyone, I'm interested to hear if you've had any experiences like this, but I feel like everyone in the world of music who I respect will have had some degree of people saying, you know, don't be so kind of, you know, don't be so creative. You know, you're not going to, you know, this isn't how it's done. You're supposed to do it like this. It's supposed to be rigid and fit into the category. And a lot of my schooling was about trying to come to terms with the fact that like these guys weren't wrong. They had a point, but like, but I had my own universe to build. I didn't really care what they felt, you know? And so I've had to come to peace with coming through those experiences and those voices and still be Jacob on the other side.
Yeah. There is, there was a thing in my family, in my culture, in my country, this thing, probably is the human experience, but who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? You can't do it your way. There was a way that existed before you, and you have to follow that way.
Exactly.
Also, there's a thing in particular, that happens in the Black American church, which is this this thing that you have to traverse. The spiritual and the secular, which is if you don't use your talent, your gifts for God, can be taken away from you. So I had this thing in my head that if I don't use it in a way that pleases the bishop, I will. You know, the old church ladies, when I was a little boy, they made it so dramatic. If you don't use it for God, he'll take it away from you. And I was like, wow, I thought my voice would be bloody. I thought I'd be spitting up blood.
Yeah, no kidding.
And,
it's crazy.
And so these are, in a way, it's a way to keep you in line and in a way to probably keep you as a member of the culture. There's probably some. You know, some perfect, reasonable rules why this happens. But
well, that's the thing. And I think this is the interesting question is, you know, are there ways of keeping people, you could say, in line or sensible or reasonable without doing that, without doing the fear thing, you know, without saying like, if you don't do this, you're in trouble. Or if you do this, you're in trouble. And I really believe there are other ways of communicating those messages. You know, my mom who brought me up, she was not a disciplinarian at all. And so there was not a sense of like, do your practice. If you don't do your practice, you're going to be a failure and, you know, all that stuff. Like that was far more how my dad was actually. Like he was much more like that. But my mom was a real open mind and she kind of gave me the wings to explore. But she wasn't without any boundaries. I think this is the interesting thing. It's like you can actually, I think it's possible. When I look back at my childhood, I think it was definitely possible to have a sense of actually this feels wrong to me or this feels right to me. And, you know, that can be in a moral sense, philosophical sense, religious sense, but also in a musical sense. And I think that one of the things that I sort of attribute my, I don't know, my freedom or confidence to is the feeling like when I felt something was right, it was right. And when I felt something was wrong, it was wrong. Me, like Jacob, my voice felt that. And it wasn't about waiting for somebody else to say this is wrong or this is right. Mm-hmm. People have opinions, but you know, it came back to me. It came back to the world that I wanted to be inhabiting and the priorities and tastes that I had. You know, I think it's amazing to think about the fact that, you know, say you and I, for example, you know, we make a very different kind of music, but the music has a lot in common because I think we've listened to a lot of the same people. But the way that the people we've listened to has gone through our minds and bodies and been digested and come out is really different. And I love that, man. I think it's tremendous because it kind of gives space for the world to be this playground. And, you know, you listen to Marvin Gaye and I listen to Marvin Gaye and out come two different things. And I think that there's a majesty about that is the complete opposite of fear. You know, it's like, it's letting yourself be the person you are and letting yourself see the world the way you want to see it.
Hey guys, you're listening to The Hang. Hit subscribe or follow on your podcast thingamajig of choice to get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses. I lost the feeling, but you give me meaning again.
Revival. With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You speak, you know, very comfortably about your journey, but we have to acknowledge that your journey has been accelerated because whether you say it or not, are you comfortable with these terms of prodigy and genius? Are you comfortable with those words?
I don't know how to think about it, really. I don't think about myself particularly as spectacular, but then I don't think anyone really does, maybe. I think that, you know, I think the word genius is interesting. And if you look at the way that the ancient Greeks used to talk about the word genius, I think they would think about it as something that happened to you rather than something that you were or are. Mm-hmm. It's like, I have a genius today. I someone opened a window into the divine, you know, and that's beautiful. And I like that. And I know the feeling. I know the feeling of having a window into the divine and be able to access that. And I know you do too. And I don't think genius is something that you own or something that you are as a constant basis, but I know the moments where I get that magic and I live for those moments.
Yeah.
But you're right in the sense that, you know, I think I've happened to gather a set of skills which, because the world is maybe as it is these days, has enabled me to have some degree of success writing music, performing music, and that's a really interesting problem to solve, you know, as you're still growing. And you know, it all happened to me quite early on, you know, not crazily early on, not 12 or 13, but, you know, 17, 18, 19 and stuff. And this is a time in your life where, you know, you don't have a clue who you are, but, you know, you're led by forces in your life, both creatively and otherwise. And I think it's a really interesting time to think about what those forces are leading you to do. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write music, and that was something that I was energized to do. And so I was doing it. But as I was doing it, the world was seeing it. And at first it was really, that was a bit dissonant. It was like, oh, I don't know if I want to show you this. I don't know. I don't even know if I like it or not. But you know, in the end it went out. And I think now I'm grateful for having had to do that and the pressure that I went through with that. And I mean, now it's interesting because, you know, more people than ever, I guess, are interested in what I'm doing or listening to the music I'm making. But I've never felt more safe just to mess around.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's something magical that's able to be possible that I found to be possible in the 21st century music industry, which is that people can trust you more than they trust the music that you make. And that grants you a really sustainable freedom in the world of creativity. Because, you know, I'm interested in and excited by so many different kinds of music. Some of the kinds of music are so different from the next. You know, it's like, how can you like Flying Lotus and, you know, Bruckner in the same sentence? And it's like, no, you can, but it takes a really broad brush. And so, you know, I make all this different, all this broad breadth of music. And I think some of it people respond to and some of it other people respond to. And that's a beautiful thing. And I think the thing that maybe I'm aiming for is a sense of my own peacefulness with the realization that I'm going to make a whole bunch of music and some of it's going to work and some of it's not going to work. And certain parts will appeal to one kind of person, certain parts will appeal to other kind of person. But if there's a sense of trust that I can build between me and my audience, then that will last longer than any particular flavor of the moment or taste that people might have. It's like a sense of, you know, I feel this way about you. You know, I know if I listen to a Gregory Porter record, I'm going to hear the world through Gregory Porter's ears, and I trust those ears, and that's cool. And that means that you can stretch me. It means that you can challenge me because I believe in you as a musician further even than the music that you're making. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's been something I've been consciously thinking about and developing this sense of kind of, you know, all the flavors are welcome within this kind of under this one roof. And that means that I don't have to be fully fledged, you know, in my creativity. I don't have to wait until I'm ready to start making something to share it with people, because I'm interested in something bigger than the music I'm sharing. I'm interested in this far grander sort of dialogue, as in the scale is what's grander, you know.
You said something earlier about we make different music, but I think we're trying to achieve the same thing. You're using your intellect, you're using your gifts. I don't think you're doing it for theory's sake.
Oh, no.
I think you're doing it to move people emotionally. And yes, I listened to your music and I was like, okay, why is he doing that? And then it hits me instantly to elevate them, to leave them hungry for something, to make them wait, to create anticipation, to build. It's all drama. And you're using these magnificent, extremely complex chords to create a tension inside their bodies. I do the same thing with my voice. I create a longing, a sadness in order to deliver some pacification in some way, maybe later on in the tune. And it is, I hear it, and it's your personality. And so this is a funny thing, is I'm sure people walk up to you and feel like they know you. By listening to your music.
Oh yeah.
And you probably have to push them off a bit. It's like, yo, back up.
I've experienced that. Yeah, for sure.
Right.
For
sure. Right. Yeah. Because you've made them feel a certain way, both with your voice and through all of this instrumentation. I am fascinated and a bit jealous at your ability to work with so many different people. That's really cool. You know, for a person who started off working on their craft in a singular kind of setting, doing things their own way, I've watched you with so many different artists and collaborating with people, and it's always dope. And I'm always like, dang. Dang, how long did they work on that? And I bet you worked on it for 30, 45 minutes, and it just and it comes out looking like you guys have been working for 3 or 4 weeks. And I'm like, man, that's really cool. That's really cool.
Oh, I really appreciate that, man.
Yeah, thank even you. To this day, I need time with people. And I'm sure you just like, come on, let's get together and let's just create some magic.
Oh, it's not always like that, honestly. There are moments where you think like, man, this is happening quick. This is really happening right now. But I think time is super important, and it's been interesting with the collaborations, because it's actually pretty rare, especially recently for obvious reasons, that I'll be in the room with them. You know, they'll come over and hang out, and we'll get to talk, and we get to talk about what they're interested in outside of music, and get to know them a bit as a person, get their sense of humor down and all this stuff. And like, these are things that make people really human, and I love that. The texture of someone when you get to know them, is that defines the music. But you know, a lot of the music, for example, on this latest album, Jesse Volume 3, a lot of it was done remotely, and that's a challenge, because you have to kind of suss someone's universe out over Zoom, and that's difficult. That's difficult to do. And I think that the time I spend on Zoom with these people is fleeting, but the time I spend afterwards thinking, okay, how can I capture what I believe to be the essence of this person? What makes this person special? What makes them tick? What turns their audience on? You know, how can I capture this thing in my own process? But and that, honestly, that can be a one afternoon, or it can be, you know, a few months of work. But but I think it's a real privilege to hold these people's worlds in my hands as the producer of the album, you know, and think, well, how can I frame this story in a way that is compelling, and how can I build a bridge from my world to the next? So I was so compelled to do this quadruple project, you know, Jesse, for this reason. I felt like, well, I've kind of done the thing of doing it all myself, you know, arranging and mixing and, you know, playing the instruments, performing it, and all the stuff, and writing the music, whatever. And I wanted to have a bit of fresh water, I guess. You know, so Jesse Volume 1 was orchestral. I, you know, did some stuff with the Metropole Orchestra, and that was super cool. And you know, I know you know those musicians, they're super special. And then you know, Volume 2, it gets cozier. The acoustic space closes in, and it's, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of more, it's more R&B, it's songwriting, it's folky, it's gentle and it's rocky. And then with volume three, it opens all out and it becomes more, you know, R&B centric poppy. It's got hip hop elements in, it's got soul elements in and digital electronic elements in. I've loved this music for my whole life, man. But but I could sit here and create my version of it all day long. But working with someone like Ty Dolla $ign or Kimbra or Leon LaHavas, you know, or Voces 8 and or Take 6, so these amazing universes in their own right that have defined so much for me. It's a real, it's like going to college, you know. Yeah. I didn't really go to college properly. So for me, this four albums, I've recently been thinking about it. It's almost like a four-year undergrad. I almost want someone to hand me a little certificate at the end and be like, you've completed your dissertation or something. Because, man, I can't tell you how much I've learned from these people.
Yeah, but I bet there are like tons of music schools and colleges that ask you to come and give a lecture.
For sure,
I know this happens. I didn't go to a music conservatory. And my musical understanding in theory is probably you have more in your big toe than I have, in your little toe than I have in my whole body. But it is interesting how, you know, you have been in the practice of music the entirety of your life. Music has been running through your veins. And so your degrees actually out. your degrees in life actually outweigh what probably that people could give you. And you're still on a journey.
Oh, still on a journey. I feel like I'm just getting started, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, how did the collaboration with you and Tori Kelly, how did that happen?
Oh man, Tori is just, she was a real hero of mine. Oh, it was a real teenage crush for me, you know, Tori. There's the voice, just unbelievable. Dexterity, crazy, you know, and she's so lovely, you know. So,
yeah.
So I know I've been wanting to work with her for a while, and it was this funny thing actually. About 3 years ago, we just sort of bumped into each other. It was actually at the Grammys, weirdly enough. It was like we were both running around like from one place to another. It was such a lot of rush on that day, and suddenly it was like, Tori Kelly, man, I can't believe it. Here you are. I love you. You
know, right.
She was like, oh, feel the same way, and it was just this fleeting moment. And it's funny. It was like later that night, after everything had sort of died down. It hadn't really died down. We were sitting in this really loud club, and everyone was going crazy, and it's like Grammy party, and we were just trying to hear each other think. It's like, hey, so who'd you listen to when you were five? You know, and just trying to get to know each other, because, you know, I think we were both such fans of each other's worlds, which, you know, blew my mind. And about 3 days later, she came over to this basement I was working out of in Los Angeles, and we wrote this tune called Running Out of Love, and well, at least we started writing it. And well, she's super seasoned, you know. It was one of those moments where you think like, well, you know how to make something happen out of thin air, like writing wise, because I was super nervous. You know, I hadn't really written with anyone before in that way, like had a session in a studio, and I'd lay down this groove with a bass and a kick and a snare, and I was like, hey, what do you think? And she was just like, it ain't always. And I was like, how did that come from?
Where did it come from?
She had it right there. It was cool.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that was 3 years ago, and we spent the next, whatever it was, 36 months kind of sitting on it. And I didn't work on it for a couple of years because I was doing volume one and volume two and stuff, and came back to it about a year ago. And I thought, man, this is actually, there's something in this that I love, you know. She's got the soul, and I love the structure of the melody is beautiful. And it's also quite minimal, especially by my standards. It's like, there's not much going on. It's kind of like a bass, a kick, a snare and a voice. And I was really drawn to that. You know, there's no kind of incandescence and stuff. So that was fun to just to sit with and spend time with. And She swung by this room actually about 8 months ago. She was actually the last visitor in my house before lockdown.
Okay.
And she came through and she kind of did the finishing touches on the song. And I knew I had something special in the bag.
Yeah, I think so. And it's cool what you even though you call it simple, there's a lot going on in the
song.
There's
a lot going on.
It's still very
some
cool.
Chords and stuff.
Little snippets here and there.
Yeah.
But so I love that. And we briefly met at the Grammys. I tell you, what happens to me is there's so much going on, and there's so many faces and personality, and there's so much music coming across.
Isn't it crazy, man?
It's bizarre. It might have been 3 years ago. It might have been that same Grammy. You were sitting right behind me. I think it was you.
That's
and
right.
Your mother.
That's right. Yeah.
And I swear to God, I turned around, I looked at you. I was like, I know him, but I can't.
can't place it. I can't place it.
I can't put it all together. I said, I think that's Jacob, but his hair is spikier than I've known it to be before. So I don't, because you know, this is the thing that could be messed up. You know, you don't want to walk up to the Temptations and say, oh man, I really love how the Four Tops have been going. You know, you don't understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Thank you for September. Right. Doesn't work out. Right.
You want to make sure the Temptations are the Temptations and the Four Tops are the Four Tops. So
we've all had moments like we've all had moments like that. Yeah.
So if I turned around and looked at you like, you know, who do you think you are? It was because I was trying to.
No, I it's funny. I remember it's all a hazy cloud. The whole the Grammys is crazy. You know, like we all know it's crazy, and I was never expecting to win the damn things. And so, you know, I have smoky memories, but I do remember you sitting right there. And
yeah.
It's a funny old thing, isn't it, man? Like you see all these people that you kind of half know, or you know, as you say, you think you know, and
right.
you really respect, or you just don't respect at all. And you're sort of in the same boat, and you're all trying to figure out. What, you know, no one really feels like they deserve to be there. It's just this funny old, it's a funny old thing, isn't it?
It's really, it's cool when one of the masters gets up and then you realize, okay, that's a master. Because at the Grammys, you can have a lot of puffery that's floating around. And then Diana Ross gets up and does her thing, and then
that's
just done. And then you're all of a sudden you're again reduced to being a child,
seeing
a real master. Where I'm going with this is like, when was the first time you met probably the greatest producer and musical mind that we've ever known? Quincy Jones. When was the first time you met him?
It's funny. I made this video. In this very room, I did an arrangement of "Don't You Worry About a Thing," which is a Stevie tune, and it was the first time in my life where I experienced that kind of virality moment. It was like, go to sleep, good, you know, good day's work, go to sleep, wake up in the morning, have a little bagel, come in, and it's like, oh 100,000 people have watched the video. What's good to feel about that, you know? But way crazier than that, which was already crazy, was my email inbox just kind of peppered with people I loved and respected. You know, Herbie Hancock had written me this message, and it was like, "Hey Jacob, you know, you're so killing." And it was like, "Are you serious? You know, are you serious?"
Shocking, isn't it? Yeah.
And then, you know, I scrolled down, and so Pat Metheny had written me a note, and it's take six, and I thought, "How in the world has this got around to this? How has this happened?" You know, and then obviously at the bottom of the pile is like Quincy, and it's like, hey, I'm Quincy Jones, and you know, I wanna hang out, and it's like, yeah, all right, I'll hang out, I'll do it, and I didn't believe it was true for a second until I saw his face on the Skype, and it's like, no, that's Quincy, that's really Quincy Jones, and then they think, well, I don't know what to say to you, Quincy, and you know, I remember he was like, hey, man, how many girlfriends you got? And I was like, I think fast, 27. And he was like, oh man, I only got 22, you know, and it was like, oh geez. and then he was like, hey man, where'd you learn those chords? And I was like, I mean, from you, man, like, what do you mean? Where did I learn those chords? I listened to you my whole life, and here you are on my screen. It was just an insane moment in my life. And, you know, fast forward 6 months, and he flew me out to the Montreux Jazz Festival, which I know we both love, and
yeah.
And you know, Herbie was there, and I met Herbie, and it was just this amazing, it was an amazing moment, man. It was like, wow, these people are not just, you know, they're not just statues, they're not caricatures, they're real, like,
they're real people,
they have flesh, they're real people, they have smells,
soulful.
And they
have armpits,
and it's amazing to realize that.
Yeah, he invited us to his house at 12 o'clock at night, and for dinner.
And yeah, I'm like, classic.
I'm like, aren't you, you know, I'm thinking, you know,
past your bedtime.
You're right. I'm thinking, you know, this is a man of advanced age. I'm thinking he's going to be winding down. And he's like, he's telling people, you know, I need a little bit of wine with this fish, you know?
For sure, so, yeah.
Yeah, he brings fish out and we're eating with our fingers. He's like, oh, you don't need no knife and fork. And it was such a surreal and beautiful moment.
Yeah.
That we're eating out of the same plates with our fingers. And we're just talking about, he's talking about, you know, Nat King Cole and Dinah Washington in a way that you speak intimately about friends. And so it was a whole different, it's even better than a book, you know?
It's unbelievable. And
it's unbelievable.
It's crazy. And he's one of those cats where you can zoom into any decade of his life and he's broken a mold. He's done something that's never been done before. He's done something impossible, achieved an incredible level of success. But he's still such a human, you know?
Right.
And I love him for that.
And it's inspiring. It's there's no need to even break out an instrument, or it's just the conversation can elevate your music. How is it that you haven't said, oh, Gregory, I think you can improve this way?
Yeah.
Just in our conversation.
Having been in the room with Ella, right? You know, like I must say, like, yeah, he's amazing like that.
Just Quincy saying to you, oh, baby, you own it. You moving, you taking it up. You turning it up. You turning the volume up. You turning the soul up. Just him saying that elevates your spirit, and can take it. So I can imagine him being in the studio with Frank Sinatra or Michael or Sammy or, you know, or James Ingram or anybody, and just those. As well as, you know, the music is buttressing him as well, but he's so optimistic and inspiring. That takes you to another level as well.
And so driven, you know. I always feel like that when I look back at his work and you think, this guy didn't rest, you know. It's like, and it's crazy that you think, you know, Thriller, Off the Wall, he was past 50 doing that stuff.
Right.
It's like, you know, most people are like, oh yeah, I'm gonna, it's a bit like, you know, what you're saying about going over at midnight. It's like, aren't you winding down now, man? Like, haven't you kind of proven your, you know, you've built castles, and it's like, no, you still got to do Thriller. And that's before, that's it. That's only the 80s, you know. Wait till he gets to the 90s and he's bridging it hip hop with jazz. And it's just crazy. It's beautiful and it's inspiring and it's human, you know, and he's so funny, you know, and I think he brings things right down to earth. And honestly, my impression of Quincy is that he's had too many stuffy conversations where people come up and is like, Quincy, I'm a friend of a friend of a friend of someone you met back in 77. And like, it's like, come on, man. Like, what, you know, what's your star sign? You know, and he'll cut right through. And I think he's gotten really good at that. He's got a good set of skills for just being like, you know what? Cut the crap. Like,
right.
Who are you, man? Like, and what do you love? And let's talk about human stuff.
That's it exactly. That's it exactly. Here was thinking that I was going to the holy grail of music, and we were gonna, like, he was gonna break something down about, you know, some musical term or whatever. And he was like, how many kids you got?
Yeah, exactly.
And I was like, I got one boy, and he's, you know, he's really the life. And he looks at my wife, puts her arm around her. He said, you need to go and have two or three more kids.
That's so Quincy. I just love that. I love that.
Yeah, he's the ability to bring his humanity to music is extraordinary. And I think ultimately in what it is that we're doing, what we're trying to do with music, it's what we're trying to do. It's what you mentioned earlier. The idea of letting your personality, your charisma, personal charisma come through the music. This thing you said about people will trust you and who you are as a person, even above what it is that you've offered them musically.
Exactly. I believe it.
It's how people can hear your intentions and hear the real meaning of a song without you telling them.
They can feel it.
Right. So really love the blues and am fascinated by the power and the brevity of the blues and how so much information is disseminated with so little and so much. And so when I sing a song or write a song like No Love Dying, a very simple, simple song, there will be no love this dying here. People have written me in so many different ways and put their own meanings. Mm. Ah, this is the song that my mother, this is for her on her deathbed. This is the song for my wedding. This is the song for, you understand what I'm saying?
People can hear it in all these different ways. I mean, I think it takes a master to do that, honestly. And I think of something that Joni Mitchell once said in an interview that I watched, and she was saying how, you know, what against which standards does she measure herself as a songwriter? And she said something along the lines of, if I write a song and the person sees me in the song I'm writing, then I failed. If I write a song and the person who's listening to the song sees themselves in the music, then that's when I'm a success.
Wow.
And I love that. I think that's beautiful. And I feel it, you know, I know what it feels like to listen to music and to hear the person who's written the music or singing the music and think, yeah, that's got an awful lot of you in it. And it's kind of about you and it's closed. It's like a closed book. But I think there's a power in the people who can write music and leave the space, whatever kind of space, you know, they respond to. Maybe it's space within the words. Maybe it's space within the harmonies. Maybe it's, you know, it's distance between phrases, or maybe it's like, it's just emotional. It's like it emotional width, you know, in amongst all the sounds that are present. It's like there's some kind of space for someone to step in and say, hey, this is my life as well as yours. And I see, as you say, I see my mother in the song. I see my father in the song. I see my daughter or my son or my friend or my lover in this song. And I think that's the sign of a universal piece of work. You know, it's when it's bigger than what you're saying. You know, it's about all the things that you could be saying. And that takes time and care and skill to refine one's ability to do that. But I hear that in your music, man. Mm. I think you do a profoundly brilliant job of telling a story which is not without sort of context and weight, but there's always room for you to hear something in the songs that is part of your own life, you know? And I think that's what makes your songs, you know, even beside your voice and how you use your voice, that's what makes your songs so resonant in the world, I think.
Thank you. Thank you for that, man. I appreciate that. As this strange time, we started our conversation off talking about how a profoundly difficult time that we're in, and we're finding ways to be creative. What do you think, and how do you think this time will affect your music and what music means to people? I mean, I don't know if you had to consider what music you'll release now.
Mm-hmm.
Is it appropriate now?
Mm-hmm.
Should I hold it back because of the environment in which we're releasing the music? What do you see as the goal and the role of music and musicians moving forward?
That's a great question and beautifully phrased. Well, I would say that one thing that I feel I've been living my life to, a flame I've been living my life in the light of for the last few years, which is a myth, is that, you know, you'll run around the world, you'll write all the music that you want to write, and then somewhere at the end of it, there's a big thing that you have that's like, yeah, I've done it. I've really got it. I completed it. It's done. There's nothing more to prove. I feel completely content, you know, and I thank you and good night. You know, I think there's a myth that people kind of have that there's a destination, you know, and that everything, it has a meaning and there's a big goal and all this stuff. And honestly, I think that for me, that was most apparent in my life when I was in education, in school, when I was a boy. And it was like, you're going to learn all this stuff And the reason for your learning is that you're going to go into the exam and you're going to nail the exam and you're going to come out with a result. And the result is going to determine who you are and why you are as you are and like what you stand for. And then that's going to mean you can go on and do the next big thing, like go to college or get a job or start a family or whatever. And I think what I've realized recently, especially over the pandemic, where I haven't been able to be as distracted as I'm used to by all the crazy stuff that I've been doing is when you think, well, what's it all for? And I think you realize it's not for anything. It's not for anything. There's no reason why we're all here. There's no reason why we're all making music. But that is such a relief to me, you know, because it does not decrease how significant the world is and how much there is to celebrate in life. And in some ways, it increases it. It's like, don't try and keep it one way forever. Don't try and stay young forever. Don't try and be creative forever and keep your idea sustained. It doesn't matter. Things rise and fall, and it's good. And that's the way things should be. That's the way things are in nature. So I've allowed myself in this period of time, besides just having been really busy working on projects and finishing stuff, to fall back in love with the part of music making for me that I initially fell in love with as a boy, which is I'm going to make music for no reason. I'm going to do it because I just love it. And I think I could learn something from it. And I just want to get a kick out of it. And I want to get higher from it, you know, and music does that for me. And I think I'm sure it does that for you as well. And I think that having climbed back into that way of thinking about music, I'm really excited moving forward in response to your question about how fresh the world of touring as one example is going to feel after this little gap. Because when we ever have a gap otherwise, you know, people are ravenous right now for the experience of being in a room. They're so ready. They're so ready to be celebrating and be free and give each other love and hold each other. And people are just so desperate. And I think that will come. It will happen. And when it does happen, I think we will all be a little bit wiser, a little bit older. And I think it will be a celebration, an unbounded celebration beyond measure, that when we can be in rooms together and sing together and play together again and really experience what it feels like to be human. And if there's one thing I think music is good for and has always been good for, and I wouldn't even say good, I'd say crucial for, it describes what it's like to be alive. It describes what it's like to be a human being and be alive. And I think that what I hope for myself, which is all I can really actively hope, is that I can enjoy and I can resource from this space more ways to tell those stories and more patience to tell those stories and more perspective to tell those stories.
Beautifully, beautifully said. In everything that you do here forward, continue to be yourself. I think what you're doing, these are the byproducts of our existence and the byproducts of our music, melding cultures on stage, giving respect to the blues and to soul music, incorporating that into classical music, mixing it with your genius. What we do on stage is giving respect to cultures. It affects people who are listening and they see, well, wait a minute. Here he is with all of his intelligence and his gifts, and he's finding a way to bring cultures together in his genius. Whatever you want to call yourself, there are other things you can hang on your name. A cultural ambassador. We are that as well. Mm. You bring in elevating women and elevating cultures who have been looked down at before. I don't know if you may not win a Grammy for it, but it's a gift to the listener and the people that are watching your career. So realize that you have that as a gift that you bring into the world as well. There's a whole bunch of things that music does and can be and will continue to be. I know people need it. And so what my advice to you as a fan is to just keep being you, man. And in that,
thank you, man.
In that it's sufficient, man. It's sufficient. And don't feel the pressure or the yoke of this thing that the industry builds up over your head. Mm-hmm. Just continue to be you. And it's nice to watch, nice to see. And every producer that I ever work with is always like, man, that dude, man, woo,
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, Greg, thanks for saying that, man. That's really brilliant to hear. And you know, I honestly feel the same way about you. I think you have such a presence in the world that no one else has. No one carries what you carry the way you carry it. I think you're such a kind of blazing light for people who want to be sonorous, you know, and sonorous in so many ways, and sonorous with their voices and with their presence and with their storytelling. You know, it's a really beautiful thing, and you're a real shining light to me and to many, many people. I think about what's possible in the world and what's important. And I really appreciate you for asking me to hop on this podcast and have this conversation. It's beautiful.
Thank you. It was a very, very cool conversation. There's one YouTube moment. It was Quincy's 85th birthday celebration. And you're in the audience with
Corey Henry.
Corey Henry. And both of you guys are together going like, as I'm singing, me and Lettucey are singing on stage. And that's all you want to do.
Bopping our heads.
That's all you want to do is you want to get the people. It's like shaking their head and bobbing their head like that and feeling something. So, you know, I put that on my resume when I, you know, whenever I tell someone, I say, check out this video. Look at what I did to these young folks, you know.
Hey, so I real pleasure. That's amazing. I remember it. I remember because me and Corey were just goofing out the whole night. You know? When you stepped up, it's like, oh yeah, we know we're in for a good time right now.
Yeah, no, yeah, it was definitely a good hang. But thank you again, man. I really appreciate
thank
you hanging
man.
With
Absolutely.
Me. Absolutely, great talking.
Yeah, hope to hang with you soon.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
And that, my friends, is one very, very cool and talented guy. If you clicked on this episode not knowing his music before, you got to go check it all out now. So there it is. That's it for another episode of The Hang. And it just leaves me to say thank you so much for hanging out with us today. If you haven't already, make sure you check out my guests from season one, including Jeff Goldblum, Jamie Cullum, Kamasi Washington, and Annie Lennox. Hit subscribe and follow. Let's all get together on our next episode. I'm Gregory Porter, and this has been The Hang, a Cup and Nuzzle production.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.